from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, May the 28th, and we have a full show lined up for you this morning. I believe we're going to be joined in just a couple minutes by Allison Novak of 7 Days. She had an interesting story yesterday about the difficulties faced by Vermont's child care industry these days. Of course, that industry already had some issues and problems that was dealing with before the pandemic. And in the pandemic, it has taken on this crucial role of providing child care, even more so to essential workers. And so child care is supposed to be getting back up into full gear these days. And there's a lot of concern about how do you manage a child care how do you manage two-year-olds and keep them 6 feet apart, I guess, is one very basic question here. So we'll be talking with Allison Novak about that in just a couple of minutes. In the latter part of the program today, we are going to be, let's see here, I've got a little list. Tracy Dolan is going to be joining us in the second half hour this morning. She is the Deputy Commissioner of Health for the state of Vermont, and I'm going to ask her a question about a lot of folks are wondering, why should I get a COVID test if I am asymptomatic? That seems to be a campaign the state has mounted. Public health officials have been mounting in recent weeks. Go get tested even if you're asymptomatic. And we're going to find out what's that about in the epidemiological toolbox. Later on, we're going to have a double header of national correspondents joining us between 10 and 10:30. Elena Treen of Axios, so we'll be the first guest, and our good friend Bob Ney will be ringing in on the second half of that half-hour segment in the third half-hour of the program today. And finally, another returning champion to the Dave Graham Show, Colin Mine of VT Digger, will be joining us for the last half-hour of the program. Haven't talked to Colin in a few weeks. He's been awfully busy managing the VT Digger coverage of the COVID-19 crisis and has been unable to break away, but today we got him for a half hour in the last part of the show, so stick around for that. He's always a very thoughtful and insightful gentleman. So, but let's start off with a newcomer to the Dave Graham Show. Always glad to welcome new guests to our program here. Allison Novak has been with an affiliated publication with 7 Days called Kids VT, and she's also doing some writing for 7 Days itself, and this week had this really interesting story about child care and trying to bring child care back to some, I don't know, new abnormal as the pandemic, people try to recover from this pandemic. I believe she's on the line with us. Good morning, Allison Novak.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining me. I wanted to check in with you and just sort of get you to recap for us for those who haven't been smart or lucky enough or whatever yet to see 7 Days this week. Sort of recap what your chief findings were in this story that has the headline "We Help WEE."
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So I wrote this week about child care centers preparing to reopen. So Governor Scott has said that on June 1st, which is next week, that child care programs can reopen as long as they abide by specific guidelines. There's a 13-page document that the state released outlining those guidelines. But many child care center providers are really concerned about reopening for different reasons. There's the safety concerns, but also financial concerns. And what those are about is that so when child care centers were closed in mid-March, the state started providing stabilization money to programs who opted in. And so basically they asked child care programs to ask their families to pay 50% tuition to keep their child care spots, and then the state chipped in the other 50%. And then for families who chose to unenroll their children in the child care programs, the state was paying 100% of those families' tuition. So that allowed child care programs to retain their staff. They didn't have to lay off their staff. The issue now is that at the end of this month, so just in a couple of days, that stabilization program will end. So the child care programs will no longer be getting that that money from the state. And in its place, the state has basically created this restart stipend program. And so they've allocated $6 million for both child care programs and summer programs who are going to reopen by July to kind of help them provide for their extra expenses that they're going to have. But most child care providers, as well as Let's Grow Kids, which is an advocacy group for early childhood education, just don't think that money is going to be enough to help these centers.
Well, the so the child care centers are basically facing kind of another wave of pinch here, it sounds like. And is it fair to say that the state support they have been getting so far is, it sounds like the summation of this is that is by and large going away? Or how would you sort of sum up the overall change here?
So those stabilization payments are ending at the end of this month. So, you know, everyone's really praised the Scott administration that I've talked to for providing the stabilization money, because a lot of states have not done anything like this. So I think Vermont has been kind of a model for the rest of the country in terms of providing this money to kind of keep these centers afloat. But the issue is that money dries up at the end of this month. And a lot of center directors are telling me that they've, you know, put out feelers to their families to see who wants to come back in June, which is when they're allowed to reopen. And many centers are reporting that only, you know, a third or a half of families want to re-enroll their kids starting in June. They're just not ready for their kids to go back. So their tuition payments are, you know, there's not going to be as much tuition coming in the summer.
Wow. So and is the reluctance or this lackluster response by families, I guess you might call it, is this really just, entirely probably reasonable COVID fear lingering on here? Or what are we thinking?
Yeah, I talked to one Burlington mom who she and her husband both work full time, and they've been working from home, and they have a kindergartner and then a baby, a 1-year-old. And her 71-year-old father has been coming to help take care of the children during this time. And so basically her kindergartner won't be going back to school until September because he's in public school. And so she feels that if she put her baby back in childcare, that she'd no longer be able to ask her father to watch the older child because it would kind of expose him to more risk. So I think a lot of families have kind of figured out alternate situations during this time, whether they have, you know, a family member who's watching the children while they work, or, you know, in some cases families have, you know, lost jobs, and so maybe then there's a parent who is able to just provide full-time child care for their children. And then there's also, I think, the fear of, you know, am I putting my child at risk to send them back?
Yeah, that is a tough situation, and I can imagine the calculus there where the mom is saying, you know, if I send my kindergarten age child to childcare every day, and then the child returns home, anytime you leave the house and you go out and you get into any kind of a group setting, there's going to be some elevation of risk there, I would assume, you know, above just playing around the house or in the yard all day. And so I guess this is all about people making these, you know, what look like from 30,000 feet, very small decisions about risk mitigation. Is that a good way to describe it, would you say? Or how
yeah,
do you,
I think that's definitely true. I think another thing that comes into the calculus is the fact that the child care centers that kids will be returning to this summer don't look like they looked in March. They look completely different. So these new guidelines require all staff members, all teachers caring for children, to wear masks. I think I've heard from parents a lot of nervousness around that, especially ones who have young children. How are those children going to react to caregivers who are, you know, are masked? There might be some fear there. And then also daily temperature checks. So, you know, when you come into the center, every child needs their temperature checked, which it's understandable. I mean, these are health guidelines that were put in place for a reason, but you know, child care is going to look different, and I think a lot of parents are feeling very wary about what it's going to look like when kids return.
Yeah. You know, child care can, in the best of times, can be a tough experience for a lot of families. There's a lot of separation anxiety for the kids, and sometimes the parents have a little pit in their stomach about the whole thing. And, you know, I remember when one of my sons was pre-age, I would drop him off every morning at the little preschool, and I'd get this lament about, I hate this school, I hate this school, and I'd have to leave them there. And it was tough, I got to say. And you know, now with the teacher wearing masks and the kid having to get a temperature taken and all these extra stresses added, I'm thinking like, oh, my word, this is a tough part of life for a lot of families already. And it's only getting tougher, folks. Yeah. Hey, 244-1777 is the call-in number here in at the Waterbury studio of WDEV FM and AM. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And Allison Novak of VT Kids, or Kids VT, rather, in 7 days. Do I have that right? It's Kids VT, right, Allison?
Kids Vermont or Kids VT, yep.
Okay, I'm not a regular subscriber these days because my kids are grown, so sorry.
Yep.
But also 7 days, and you had a good article in 7 days about the sort of current state of the daycare situation or childcare situation here in Vermont with this. We're trying to recover and turn the spigot, as the governor says, and get past to the extent we can all the disruptions of this pandemic. Even though the pandemic doesn't seem to be in and of itself completely going away, certainly not nationwide. And I think the governor is rightfully concerned that even in the states surrounding us, seems to be still a lot more presence of the COVID-19 virus than we are lucky enough to have in Vermont, I guess, right now. But, hey, let's take a caller. Rama is checking in from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. This is going to be an ask and go. So, and this is relating to these COVID-related syndromes we're finding in infants, young children, and even going up into teens. There's an inflammatory, a COVID-related inflammatory syndrome, which has been causing a lot of problems for very young children. There's other syndromes they've been associating with the COVID-19, with even going up into the teens, et cetera, but mostly pertaining to these daycares, et cetera. I haven't heard a lot of discussion. I haven't heard. Doesn't mean it hasn't been going on in public anyway. Are people aware of, following, and concerned about these various syndromes? So I'm going to hang up and go. Thanks.
Thank you, Rama. Allison, what did you hear from folks about all that?
So the Department of Health has numbers of the number of children in Vermont who tested positive for COVID. There has only been one child under the age of 9 who has tested positive for COVID in Vermont. But we don't know how many children have been tested, and that's information that I'm trying to get because I think that number is really important to know how many children have been tested, to know what to make of that one child testing positive. So, you know, I do think Vermont has done a really good job in obviously keeping numbers low across the board, but also there have been very few cases of children testing positive for COVID. I mean, I do know in the early days, though, children were not being tested, even those who exhibited some symptoms. You know, I think that the inflammatory syndrome is on the radar of the Department of Health here. I know in New Hampshire, there was just the first case reported of that inflammatory syndrome in a child. And so I think, you know, that is something that when in talking to parents, I've heard concern about that. There have not been any reported cases in Vermont yet.
Yeah, well, let's hope that remains the case, although I must say, you said that earlier on in the pandemic, kids were just not being tested. Are kids being tested now, or is that a growing thing, or is that still the case that they are largely not being tested?
I have heard some instances of kids being tested in May. I am working on a piece actually about a childcare center in Brattleboro that was open for essential workers. And two teachers tested positive for COVID, and they did test the children at the center, and they all tested negative. You know, I do think that children are being tested now, especially if there's a reason to, if you know, there's someone they've been in close contact with that has tested positive. But, you know, I do know in those early days they weren't. And I did speak when I was reporting for this piece for 7 days, I did speak to a childcare provider down in Proctor, who her whole family had COVID in March, and her husband was the only one tested. And he tested positive. He was sick, and the rest of the family, the five other members of the family, were all sick, but none of them were tested. And that included, you know, two children who were 9 and 13. So, So I think, you know, there are these things I'm hearing in terms of, like, children who were sick in March and April but never had a test.
Allison Novak of Kids Vermont and 7 Days, my guest this morning. And we have another luminary on the phone, I guess you might say. Dave Zuckerman, the Lieutenant Governor of Vermont, is holding an event this morning, or I guess noontime, on the whole subject of child care in Vermont. And when I scheduled Allison in this first half hour, I texted Dave and said, hey, you might want to call in and plug your event. So take it away, Dave Zuckerman.
Well, sure. Today at noon, I've got a couple of child care center experts, Donna Bailey, the executive director of the Addison County Parent Child Center, as well as Deb Gass, the executive director of the Early Education Services in Brattleboro. And I'm going to be having a similar conversation with them at noon today on my Zuckerman for VT Facebook page. And folks can watch that live and potentially even chime in with a question in the chat if I can grab it. And talking about these exact issues, you know, how do these child care centers function both financially and in a healthy way for the kids? How do we make it possible for the folks that are working there to both stay safe and create opportunities for those kids not to be scared? I think, the story that has just been done that, you're talking about is it's on a lot of these things. Allison covered a lot of these topics, and just to get some first person voice from these folks, what's going to happen? Why is the state, pulling back on the resources for basically one of the most important pieces of getting our economy going again, as well as getting some sense of normalcy for these kids, even though obviously it won't be normal with masks and the spacing issues.
Yeah. Well, Dave Zuckerman, thank you for checking in. I really appreciate it. And how do folks find your event? Just go on Facebook and look for Zuckerman for VT?
Or at Zuckerman for VT, and that'll show up the Facebook page. It's at noon today for about 45 minutes, because then I've got to run over to the Senate floor and continue to do that part of my job.
As the Senate
is continuing all of June here and maybe longer.
Got it. Okay. Thanks again for the call, Dave. Always good talking with you.
Okay.
Allison Novak, I just because you and I are kind of scooping Dave this morning, I guess. You scooped us all yesterday, so nobody should feel bad about this. It's all important information that should get out in any way and any timing it can. And so, but anyway, the question I was going to ask you actually was, Dave touched on it a little bit, which is just talk to me a little bit about the about the logistics, the spacing issues. Before the show today, I was doing a little promo on it, and I said, how do you keep a couple of two-year-olds who want to poke each other or something 6 feet apart?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something that the Department of Health has acknowledged, that that's going to be really difficult, both to keep young children socially distant from each other and also to have them wear masks. Initially, when the guidelines came out, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, one of the guidelines did say to have children over two wearing masks at childcare if possible. But there seemed to be a little wiggle room there in terms of, what does that mean if possible? So, a lot of young children, they wouldn't be able to keep a mask on. They'd be touching it. They'd be sucking on it. And that, would just basically negate the positive effects of wearing a mask. So I think the Department of Health, I've heard a couple of webinars that they've given basically saying that, try to have young children wear masks, but, we understand that it's not always possible with young children. In terms of napping, I think, there's some guidelines around when young children are napping, they have to be head to toe, they have to, be spaced out. Also, in terms of play equipment, I know that that has to be sanitized, regularly. So if one group is on the play equipment and then another group is coming out, it has to be cleaned down, wiped down before the second group comes out. Also, in terms of drop-off and pick-up, there's going to be a lot it's going to look a lot different. So, parents are going to have to drop their children off, not in the classroom, but kind of at the door. And again, like you said, with some kids who already have some separation anxiety, I think that's going to be tricky for some families.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing all the way around. And are you hearing from any families that they are sort of giving up? And I mean, you mentioned that one Burlington couple who has, I guess, a grandparent basically coming in and providing some child care in the household. And I'm sure that's still a fairly common phenomenon in Vermont. But are there any other is how big a phenomenon is it of a family saying, you know, we are going to kind of just get out of this this child care situation and try another path, maybe cut down to one job between the couple or bring in a relative or do something, some other alternative, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think those conversations are happening around the kitchen table in many households. And, you know, I've heard anecdotally about some people who have young children who are maybe seeking out some, like a nanny or someone who could provide in-home care, feeling like that's a safer option. So, I'm not sure if that's really become a big trend right now, but I think that that's something that I've heard that families are definitely considering, whether they could maybe share a nanny with one other family or do something so that they don't have to utilize the child care programs right now. I think everyone's kind of weighing the risks and, you know, do I want my child to go back to a program where there's going to be all these guidelines? I do think child care providers are working really, really hard to make kids comfortable when they come back. In my story, I write about a home provider in Montpelier who's made a pin the mask on Aubrey game. So basically children can get comfortable with her wearing a mask and can see that under the mask she's smiling. She's also made up little pins she can put on her shirt that show her smiling face so that they know that she's smiling underneath the mask. So, you know, I do think child care providers are really committed to making kids feel, safe, but I do feel like they're also kind of questioning, like, is this the developmentally appropriate way to care for children?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was just thinking, is this sort of the modern COVID-19 era take on the old pin the tail on the donkey game? Or
Exactly. It's a little game where there's a Velcro mask that kids can put on her mouth. So there's a big blown up picture of her. And it's a way to kind of try to normalize the mask wearing, I guess. So I guess it's just an example of how I think providers are really trying hard to make it a welcoming environment for kids to come back to.
Of course, when I was a kid, I think the Lone Ranger wore a mask. So maybe some kids would get excited by role models like that. Who knows?
But
but in terms of the back to sort of the where the logistics meet the finances, and we are getting low on time here. But I sort of wanted to circle back to this issue of our daycare or child care centers finding that they need to. They need to reduce, intentionally reduce. I know some are having trouble getting their families back, but to the extent they want. But others may be saying we need to have fewer kids in our building at a given time, just so we can maintain that social distancing. And of course, then that has an impact on tuition revenue and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So the guidelines say that children must be kept in small groups, not more than 25 individuals in a single classroom, which is pretty high, I think, especially for child care programs. I mean, there's also other regulations in terms of, you know, how many infants can be in a child care classroom. So I think, but I do think centers are seeing that 25 is like, not, I mean, many of them, I think, are planning for much lower numbers of children in classrooms. So, I mean, I think that is an issue. I do also think the fact that, you know, people aren't ready to come back and that they're just anticipating smaller numbers right now is, you know, weighs into this financial bind that they're in.
All right. Well, so just on a personal note, is childcare kind of a full-time beat for you? You're doing multiple stories on this, and I know your background in writing for a publication with, you know, an affiliated publication for mainly geared to families with young kids and so on. Is that the is that a real full-time beat for you as a reporter these days?
Yeah, I am. I'm going to be doing more childcare stories for 7 days, definitely throughout this summer. Also maybe hoping to look at schools when that starts, when decisions start being made about kids going back to school. So So yeah, it's something that I'll be covering for 7 days going forward.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that 7 days is putting, you know, is devoting a significant amount of staff time to this topic, because it is a very important part of our sort of social fabric these days. You know, I think especially some of the older listeners to the show here on WDEV may remember a time when there really wasn't much organized. Wasn't much organized childcare. You know, probably grew up at a time when if their parents were working, there were grandparents around or something. Different mm-hmm. world these days, and it's great to see a media outlet like 7 Days grab onto that and make it a thing and really make sure that it gets thoroughly covered, all the issues connected with it and so on. Allison Novak's been my guest the first half hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV this morning, and I really appreciate you joining me, Allison. Let's talk in the near future.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Hey, we are coming into a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News on the Dave Graham Show, and we're going to be hearing a couple of words from our sponsors, and I wanted to make mention of one programming note for tomorrow. I believe I'm going to be joined by Janet Ansel in the first half hour of the show tomorrow. She's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and going to be talking about a possible formula for a way out of the big hole in the education fund. So join us again tomorrow for that. But stay tuned for the rest of our show this morning. We are just about to head out to a break for some CBS News, and when we return, we'll be talking to Tracy Dolan of the Vermont Department of Health. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Entering into the second half hour of our program this morning, thanks for staying with us. And we have had probably three times previous now, I'm thinking. I don't have an exact count, I must admit. But Tracy Dolan is the Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, and she has been helping us out understanding what the state is doing, the public official response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, we go 9 to 11 in the morning, and the governor comes on at 11 o'clock with a range of state officials talking about all these issues. And our timing isn't perfect there as far as the Dave Graham Show goes, but Tracy's been coming up to bat for us and helping us get caught up, and really appreciate her participation. She's back today. I believe she's on the line. Tracy, thanks for joining me again this morning.
Hi, good morning, Dave. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
That's good. So I wanted to check in with you because I am personally curious. And I'm also hearing this from a few other people I've talked to about it, which is, do I have it right that there is a big push on from the health department and folks who are trying to help it do its messaging, et cetera, that it's a good idea for folks who are asymptomatic, meaning I don't feel sick, but I should go get tested for the COVID-19 virus. Is that right?
We're putting up clinics, and we have been for the last couple of weeks, and we're welcoming people who are interested in getting testing, even if they're asymptomatic, and they can come and get a test. This helps us get a sense of how much disease we have in our population right now, so it gives us a sense of the prevalence or the incidence, how many new cases we have. Because we have low incidence right now, so we have low numbers of new cases, doing a lot of testing will help us find those small numbers of cases and then try to isolate those cases and contain our pandemic.
And I'm wondering what your sense is and what the sense is among your colleagues there about kind of how you're doing. You know, sometimes a business will come out with a new product or service and put it out there in the marketplace, and then the question comes, are people buying it? And so would you say that people are showing up for these tests to the degree that the folks at the health department hoped?
Yeah, you know, we have quite a few people showing up, hundreds at each clinic, and it's likely, especially in Vermont, because our incidence rate is pretty low, it's likely that we'll see demand continue to go down. That's happening actually all over the country. Every week I talk to others in my position in public health across the country, and we are seeing demand go down, and particularly in areas where the case numbers are going down, and that's natural. We're also going to shift a little bit more to look at who's most vulnerable and look at increasing some testing in those facilities as well.
And I know that there is a list of people you sort of suggest, and you know, among the folks who are maybe priorities for testing would be someone who's just returning to Vermont. This doesn't happen that much this time of year for say college or something, or returning from down south where they may have spent the winter or something. So a lot of this is designed to catch people coming into Vermont who, you know, maybe do have big connections here but have been away, and try to make sure that they are COVID free. Is that right?
Yeah, returning Vermonters, it's a really important one, or people coming in and staying for a while, because we know that while Vermont is doing pretty well in terms of our case rate, our neighboring states are challenged, and some of them are going through surges and peaks right now. So we are really encouraging anyone who's returning to Vermont to get tested, anyone who's going to come in and stay. So we've got students showing up for June 1st leases around the Chittenden County area, for example. We'd like them to get tested. So we're working with UVM so they can get tested and quarantine. If you're coming into Vermont and you've been gone for more than a day, you actually have to quarantine for 14 days. And we're working on that policy right now, but it's likely that you will be given the option to test partway through that so that you can get out of that quarantine. But we really need to protect what we have right now. And that's either for people from out of state or Vermonters who are leaving and coming back. And so that's important. And so testing will allow us to, you know, pull people out of quarantine earlier. And we're just doing some finalization on that policy. So hopefully you will hear about that soon.
So talk to me a little bit about the folks who leave and come back. Leaving and come back can range from, you know, you live in White River Junction and there's cheaper gas over in Lebanon, you know, so you go over for across the river for 10 minutes to you know, going down to Massachusetts to visit family or something for a weekend. I think there are a lot of folks who might sort of look at a 14-day quarantine for a 2-day visit? What's up with that?
Yeah. And if you're
talk to those.
Sure. If you're just going across for the day, shopping, getting gas, whatever it is, you can come back and not quarantine. Although we would ask you to just be aware in the next few days. I mean, this is a highly transmittable disease. The R-naught factor for that, which is a public health term, epidemiological term that describes how many people you pass it on to, is about 2.3, 2.4. So for anyone who has this illness, on average, they pass it along to about 2.5 people, highly transmissible. And it doesn't take long, you know. A close contact is anyone closer to 6 feet within your distance, and especially with no masks. And you only have to be with that person for, you know, 10 minutes, maybe in an hour to be able to get this. So it's not a small risk. So we're saying if you go out and back for the day, that's pretty low risk, assuming that you were careful. But if you're out for more than that, it's a real calculation. So you may decide not to go visit in family in Massachusetts because you are being asked to quarantine when you get back. Not just, you know, stay away from people, but full-on quarantine. We don't want you out and about because, you know, we're doing pretty well right now. But as we know, once this hits vulnerable populations, this causes people to become very sick and in some cases die. And we really want to avoid needless illness and needless death.
Yeah, it's just tough. I mean, there's some aspects of this whole thing that I think, you know, just a layperson who's not a public health expert looks at it and kind of goes, oh, man, that just seems... I mean, the reverse thing would be In fact, we in our household, we've been talking about my wife's sister coming up to visit with some of her kin, her husband and kids, and like around the 4th of July. And again, this would be like a 3-day visit for some people who actually live in South Carolina. So
and they'd have to be inside the whole time and not congregating with anyone. You know, they'd have to be on your property the whole time. You know, it is tough. The only thing tougher than having to, you know, go away, visit family, come back and quarantine, the only thing tougher than that is watching your grandparent, you know, become terminal and pass away in a long-term care facility and nobody can be with her as she dies. That's tougher.
Yeah. And I guess, putting all this in perspective. Yeah, and that perspective is, I mean, the reason I'm asking these questions is because I kind of want to get that out there because it's vitally important, and I think one of the hard things for you must be must be to sort of keep people on their toes. I think there's a normal, you know, there's sort of a natural human tendency for people to want to make things back to normal and maybe even get a little complacent about things or whatever, but really there are still high risks connected, even in a state which has been very, very diligent about and successful relative to other neighboring states, even.
We're low risk here in Vermont because we have low numbers of people who are sick. But the virus hasn't become any less transmissible or any less dangerous. And that's really what people need to understand. Once it's here and once, you know, it's in your community, you are not inoculated in any way just because you live in Vermont and we have a low case rate.
Yeah, that's an important reminder, I guess, for folks because, you know, again, I sort of think that there may be, I mean, I just sense among friends and folks I talk to from time to time, that there may be a little bit of, a softening or a slight shift in attitude or whatever. Are you worried about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you feel it everywhere. You feel it within yourself. I mean, I come here and work every day, and I start feeling, I look outside, it's beautiful, it's summertime. It's just easy to start feeling like you're in some other world and that you're on safer ground. And I even live this every day, so I can't imagine the layperson who's not around this every day looking around, not seeing anyone sick. It's a natural tendency, and we have to fight our natural tendency right now and really listen to the public health guidance, which is wear the mask, do the social distancing, and if you're going to go out of state, be very aware of what's happening out there, and when you come back, please quarantine so that you can protect the people in your community and our loved ones, and particularly those who are already elderly or sick, because they do not have the defenses that a lot of us have, and it does rip through those communities, and it's brutal.
Yeah, and I just wonder also in terms of the real kind of practical ways that people live their lives. You know, a lot of people last summer would have been thinking about, I'm going to take a couple of weeks off in August and maybe, you know, go over to Maine or down to Cape Cod or something and have a little vacation and, you know, that sort of thing. Assuming that to the folks who actually still have jobs, and maybe their jobs offer them a couple weeks vacation every summer, right? Now they're in a situation where they're going to come back from the Cape or someplace, and they're supposed to be out of work for another 2 weeks, right?
That's right. That's how it is. Yep. Unless something changes drastically, that's what we anticipate for the foreseeable future. So if you have a couple of weeks vacation, it might not make sense to go out of Vermont for your vacation unless you are very comfortable with the idea that when you come back, you're going to be quarantining.
Yeah.
It has not gone away. We're going to have another surge in the fall. So
of course,
we can either let it go and let it go all through our community, or we can do everything we can to try to limit it.
Yeah, a lot of employers, the vacation time is limited. I mean, people have, you know, CTO that they use up in some work settings. Other folks have a union contract that says you get 2 weeks vacation and at your level of years of service or whatever. And no, the boss doesn't want to give you another 2 weeks off to go quarantine after you get back from your 2-week vacation. So
that's right.
A lot of sort of practical considerations. Now, the other, I mean, it sounds like one possible answer here, and tell me if this makes more sense or just sort of how bulletproof this is, if it is at all, and that is take your vacation in Vermont, and then you don't have to.
Absolutely, yeah. You assume that your vacation is a staycation, so you stay in Vermont. I mean, I would be very surprised if we have a lot of people going out, because we are really going to push for that that quarantine when you get back. And
okay,
but
let's
people respect it.
Let's say instead of renting a cottage on the Cape, I'm going to rent a cottage. You know, I live in Montpelier, and I say, well, maybe I've never really checked out, I don't know, pick a lake, Lake Bomazene. I've never really checked out Lake Bomazene before. I'm going to go get a summer rental down there for a week. I don't need to quarantine when I come back from Lake Bomazene, do I?
Is that in Vermont?
Yes.
Yes, no.
Rutland County.
If you're in Vermont, you don't have to. Yeah, even that's Vermont. if you're in Vermont, you don't have to quarantine. So, I mean, that's absolutely the key. If you're going to leave, you have to quarantine. And I really hope that there's a lot of positive peer pressure to really push people to do that, because it's just, you know, there was a frat party in Plattsburgh 2 weeks ago. A bunch of kids got together. Their rate was pretty low. And suddenly we've got an outbreak from one party, like 20 cases.
Wow.
It doesn't take much. Yeah.
Yikes. And I mean, I guess let me play the devil's advocate here a little bit, because there's something counterintuitive here that says to me that because, again, I mean, I'm going to use this example of, it could be any one of those lakes in Rutland County, let's say, and I only pick Rutland County because I live in Washington County, and it's a little bit of a getaway, right? You know, an hour and 20 minutes or something. And so I'm going to go on vacation and rent a camp on Lake Hortonia or Lake St. Catherine or Lake Bomazene or one of those down there. And I might say to myself, it seems a little arbitrary to say that if I do that, I have different rules than if I take my, and you know, go and rent a camp on Lake Chateauguay over in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, but we can't go case by case, right? Because you can't set policy that way. You can't have everybody put in their paperwork and say, well, your cottage was isolated, so you're okay. Yours wasn't, so you're not okay. I mean, you know, that's not how public policy works. So we have to be pretty clear, because we're going state by state, and we're looking at states and realizing that they are still challenged in a way that we're right now. So it just, as much as I understand that people feel that way, we can't go case by case that way.
Let's go to a caller. We have Wade checking in from Corinth. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Ms. Dolan. So first, I have a question. And again, it's a kind of a personal, or like Dave, I have a sister coming to Vermont. But on her way, she's going to quarantine in an isolated home in Maine. Does that count for the 14-day quarantine to then come to Vermont and be clear?
So I don't want to get ahead of the governor, but Dave, are you okay if I just answer directly, or do you want me to pause and do you want to say something each time?
No, you go right ahead.
Okay, thanks. See, we haven't worked this out in advance. So right now, I mean, I know the governor hasn't been hasn't come out clearly on where the quarantine is, or if there's going to be a change in that. But so our status quo right now is that you quarantine in Vermont when you get to Vermont. So I can't give any more advice than that. But the idea is to quarantine when you arrive. We have talked about the possibility of being able to get tested on day 7. And if you're negative, then that would release you from the quarantine. But again, the governor, we're holding on the governor's final policy on that. So right now, as it stands, you quarantine when you get here.
Yeah. Okay. And is there paperwork that people have to do when they come? And where
no.
can they find that?
No.
Nope.
There's no paperwork.
Honor system. That's good. And then I do have a comment on top of that. Am I still here? So I personally drive a route. It takes me about 150 miles a day, 75 miles twice a day. So I'm going through the same communities, counties, towns through. So I really get to observe the same situations, you know, day to day. And I've seen town municipality crews, 3 different roofing crews, at least 1 paving crew on separate jobs, even one of our major utility companies on a major project for the last month, and there is all but 0 compliance for wearing masks in the workplace.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge. I mean, I do see some of them wearing masks. I went through Richmond. I saw some crews out there. I mean, again, they don't need to wear it if they are not near each other, but if they're near each other, those masks should be up.
Hand tools and working face-to-face, toe-to-toe.
Yeah.
You know, almost zero compliance. So I'm wondering if they got, I know for my employees, we had to, we had to go through the VOSHA training.
Yeah.
49 page and come up with our own plan, and everybody has to sign a signature page they read and understand and will comply.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge, and we're continuing to hope that with more education and more pressure that people will comply. But at this point, I know the governor is really wanting to move in the direction of voluntary compliance, and we're doing everything we can to push employers to really get their employees on board.
So unfortunately, with the better weather and now that things have opened up for crews to be out there and bigger crews, I've actually seen from some compliance initially to now zero compliance across the board.
Yeah. Yeah, it is problematic.
Unfortunately. Yep. Okay.
Tracy,
have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Wade. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jackie in Cabot. Good morning, Jackie.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, but I just tuned in and I was listening to your commenting about Lake Bomasene and Lake Hortonia.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, so we had a scheduled vacation to Virginia over Memorial Day weekend, and we on the beach, which was open, and we canceled it because we thought we needed to do the right thing and stay home here. So we went camping in Bomasene, and they wouldn't let you do an online reservation. You had to call and you had to give them information that said you were a Vermonter. We got down there and we got there on Friday. We left on Tuesday. We were surrounded by New York people who came and went at will. They partied. They went home. They came back. They went fishing. I mean, because we could hear them and we knew the vehicles came and went all day. And I said to my husband, 2 to 4 weeks, we're going to have another occurrence because nobody down there cared. And we were watching the traffic, and it was New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. I mean, I just feel so badly that this state has done so well, and it's going to be the others that cause our problems. And I understand the frustration from the health department about not doing what you're supposed to do, but good heavens. You know, the fact that we were not challenged, but we were questioned as to where we were coming from, which we thought was a good thing, and we got to this campground and we kept thinking, well, maybe it was the summer people who are just coming from New York and they're staying, and they're going to quarantine at the campground. So okay, we gave them the benefit of the doubt, but by the third day, we knew that was not the case. They were coming and going at will, and it was funny because we actually crossed the border to go to a local produce stand that we thought was open, and we saw the guy sitting there counting our truck as we went across the border. And 2 minutes later, we were back because the place was closed, but we were followed by streams and streams of New York people coming into Vermont. So I just, when you started talking about Lake Bomasene, I just
kind of struck a nerve. Huh?
We were just there, and it's not working. It was pretty bad. I mean, it was
okay.
And they say camping's the safest. I mean, we didn't interact with these folks at all, but the playground was not blocked off, so the kids were on the playground. The pools were closed. But there's a lot of that kind of, and I understand that the business owners need to open, and I understand that they need to, have some income. But I don't understand why we were challenged, and everybody else just streamed in back and forth and back and forth. It was pretty. If it hadn't been bad, it would have been funny. So I agree
Maybe.
With Ms. Dolan. I think there's going to be another wave of this because we've got people coming in that just don't care. So that was my 2 cents. Thanks. We did have a good vacation, but it was a little scary.
A little weird, yeah. Jackie, thank you for the call.
I wonder if I can... I wonder if I can just jump in on the as much as it's true, certainly people coming in from other areas are putting us at risk, but we put ourselves at risk too. So I just don't want to go too far down the road of us versus them, because of course the vast majority of our cases in Vermont have been Vermonters, because this is an illness that's across the country. And so while we may have some introduction from out of state, It's a lot about our behavior too, right? So let's assume that there is going to be some mixing because that's going to happen throughout the country. And then what do we do differently, right? We wear our masks, we socially distance, we wash our hands, we do all the things that we need to do as well. And so I just want to be a little bit careful about too much blame as well. That might introduce it, but then it's about how we behave to help contain it.
It's never going to be risk-free out there, but we can do what we can to mitigate the risk. Is that right, Tracy Dolan?
It is, yeah, and I'm going to have to jump off in just a couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, actually, we got to jump off now because we're about out of time, but I really appreciate you checking in with us this morning, and I thank you so much, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, Tracy Dolan. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Hey, heading into some CBS News at the top of the hour, and then a couple of national correspondents, and we'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and we have a surplus crop this morning of national correspondents. We're going to go to two, starting with Elena Treen of Axios, and then our good friend Bob Ney, formerly of Talk Media News, now freelancing on his own, but he'll be joining us for the second part of this half hour. I believe we have Elena Treen on the phone with us already. And Elena, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And we are I'm looking at some of the Elena, the Axios. You're Elena. This is Axios. You work for Axios. Mm-hmm. Let's get this straight, Dave. The end of the beginning. And are we at the end of the beginning on the energy companies' net zero carbon pledges?
Yes, I believe that, you know, some of my colleagues who work in much more closely in the energy sphere, they believe that, I mean, looking at the way that the coronavirus has had an impact on what we've seen, you know, carbon use as well as pollution, of course, across the world and in the U.S., I think it's made very clear to a lot of people who work in the industry, the type, you know, just the way that we've seen pollution reduced. We've seen, you know, those pictures, those very famous pictures now of places in India and others where the air is clearer than it's been in several years. And it's just a step at looking at, okay, what do we need to reach, bridge that gap in the future? And what are the lessons we're learning from having everyone locked down right now and having usage across the world pulled back? What lessons can we learn from this right now to apply in helping, you know, reach, like you said, the end of the beginning?
Yeah, it's sort of a tough two-edged sword, though, because, I mean, on the one hand, just politically, you know, where the crossroad, the nexus is between politics and energy, you know, one person will say, well, see, this lockdown is showing us what we can do to clear the, to basically clean up the environment and clear the air, and all of a sudden, you know, have these beautiful pictures coming in from Los Angeles and places in India that were choked with smog before and so on. And then the counter argument will come and say, yeah, it shows that if we're really going to get serious, if we get as serious as you, Mr. Liberal, want to be about, or Ms. Liberal want to be about climate change, we're going to have to shut down our economy.
Right.
So and it's.
I'm sorry, but just to jump in, I do think that a lot of some of these industry leaders and activist investors, which is what a lot of the story I think you're referring to, discusses on our page this morning. But a lot of it is investors being worried about what will happen depending on who will fill the White House in November. So whether it, you know, remains to be President Trump, who we've seen has rolled back a lot of regulations on some of these pushes to, you know, restructure the way that our country looks at climate. Of course, he pulled the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. President Joe Biden would definitely have a different approach to the way that we view climate change. And so a lot of the decisions that are being made now are kind of anticipant of what might happen. And so, yes, I do think that, like we said, what's happening right now and seeing the effect on climate change during lockdown is starting to motivate a lot of companies to try to commit to some of these more ambitious climate targets. But again, a lot of it is dependent on what they're worried about, the policy and the regulations that could be, you know, further placed or rolled back, depending on who ends up in the Oval Office after the general election in November.
All right, let's shift gears to another topic that's getting a ton of coverage, Axios and elsewhere, and that is, of course, race relations this week. We've had incident in Minnesota where an unarmed black man died after being having his neck kneeled on by a police officer. And then this other weird thing in New York City where a woman called the police and threatened to tell them that, or I guess did tell them that she was being threatened by an African-American man, and his only purpose in the encounter was to try to get her to put her dog on a leash. Yikes. Mm-hmm. What's going on out there?
It's horrific, and it's something that we've seen happen time and time again in our country, and it's mind-boggling that it still happens and that we're, you know, that it continues and we're not seeing changes. And I do appreciate that a lot of the attention put on these two cases specifically, or several cases, I guess we talked about, of course, George Floyd, who was in the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. We saw the shooting of Mr. Aubrey a few months ago, but that got a lot of attention thanks to social media. And then again, that woman who had her dog on, who had her dog off her leash and had a confrontation with an African-American man in Central Park. A lot of these issues are being brought to light by the media, and you know, it makes you wonder, there's so many issues that are happening that, like this every day, that aren't getting the attention or spotlight, you know, and it's a massive issue in our country. Now, from the politics perspective, we saw yesterday the president tweet that he has requested the FBI and the Justice Department to investigate the death of George Floyd in Minnesota, who was killed by police officers. And then we also saw that former Vice President Biden compare that tragic death of Mr. Floyd to Eric Garner during a virtual event yesterday. And so it's getting a lot of attention. We've seen politicians across the country really try to shed light on it. But it's a horrific thing. And I think we have to, you know, pay a lot more attention to it. And I think bringing light to it, talking about it on the radio like we are now, writing about it, having people share these things on social media is a great way to draw attention to it, because it's something that needs to be dealt with in a way that we haven't really seen in our country.
Well, and one of the things interesting about this New York case is the Independent, a UK publication, had a piece about Amy Cooper, the woman involved who you know, they described as a liberal who had given money to Barack Obama and Pete Buttigieg and other Democrats. And I think one of the lessons there to me, and tell me if you think I'm crazy, but a lot of times, especially on social media, but in our general discourse, these labels of liberal and conservative get tossed around rather broadly. And you very often have an individual who may be, you know, sort of liberal on, I don't know, reproductive rights and environmental protection and maybe even income inequality, but has a real difficulty and needs a lot of, you know, needs a lot of education about race, just for one example. And so I think that sometimes these labels are thrown around rather loosely, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and I do think that just because you might identify as a Democrat or Republican, liberal, conservative, doesn't mean that you aren't still racist or you aren't bigoted, homophobic. We see that happen in regardless of what you label as your party identification. The way that you act and what you say to people and the way that you treat others is a much better example than whatever identification you, what label you put on yourself.
What needs to happen to? I don't want to completely equate these two cases—the horrific death of George Floyd and this confrontation in Central Park—but it just seems as though, if there is any commonality here, maybe it's that the people involved who end up in a bad light, frankly, have never been exposed to certain kinds of education or something. You know, they've never been to a class where a discussion you have, I don't know, of explicit versus implicit bias and the rest of the sort of language of and thought processes that a lot of people think are necessary to understand what some of the issues are here and that kind of thing.
Right.
Is it all about education?
In a way, yes. I think that our schools probably need to do a better job of education on these issues. But I also think that, you know, we're in 2020. We're not in the 1960s. We have access to media, newspapers. Everyone can look up what's going on in the world just from their phones. And the world itself has become a lot smaller because of it. And so I think a lot of people, regardless of where you live or what socioeconomic status you have, hopefully have access to what's going on in the world and these big issues. And that should be educating us across the country. But yeah, I'm sure education is a big part of it, where you were born, the life that you live, the type of family and their values that you have. All of those always, of course, contribute to your outlook on life. And that's what we've seen, you know, not just in whether you have your views on race and other issues, but party identification again and things like that. But I think our country needs to do a better job of, you know, yes, we're not in 1960, this is 2020, but things like this shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't see police officers, you know, pressing down with their knee on someone's neck and, you know, having these issues constantly in the media. It makes you wonder, like, what will it take to stop? And I think we need to do a better job of addressing these issues so that, you know, we don't see this happening all the time. It shouldn't be happening in our country.
Yeah, well, that's I would agree with that, and I certainly think that there appears to be a lot of work to do here in a lot of different parts of our society. So, Elena Treen of Axios, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Always a good, insightful discussion from you, and let's do it again soon.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, Dave.
And joining us now is Bob Ney. He was with something called Talk Media News for a long time. I believe he's out on his own these days, but still providing excellent analysis and insight on what's going on the national scene. And Bob, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you, Dave.
And you've been, of course, staying on top of lots of different news coming around. And I see one headline in the note you sent me. It says European leaders urge Netanyahu against West Bank annexation. He is waiting for a green light from Trump. And, you know, I think people get so COVID focused and so on and politics focused in the U.S. We sometimes tend to forget there is a rest of the world out there. So this is good. Tell us what's going on.
Correct, Dave. You know, even when COVID 19 isn't around, we still tend to forget there's the rest of the world sometimes, unless it.
Yeah, I think that forgetfulness is on steroids right now or something.
Right.
Anyway.
And this is a big story that really didn't get any attention anywhere practically. Axios did carry it, and that's where I picked it up. But what's ended up happening, there's a West Bank annexation, which Israel would actually technically annex areas that are probably going to go in a peace settlement into a Palestinian state, a two-state solution, having Israel and a Palestinian state side by side. Well, basically, the Trump administration has yielded, you know, officially, but without peace talks, has yielded to everything Netanyahu has wanted. Now, we can debate, is that good or not? But the fact remains, we have done that, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, annexing the West Bank is to be decided yet. You know, certain parts in the valley that would belong to Israel. Also, these settlements that are created, which are a big controversy. So on and on. And Trump, for the most part, has, you know, said, I'm going to have my son-in-law, Jared Kushner, develop this peace plan. But when they developed the peace plan, they developed it without the Palestinians, literally. The Palestinians, their attitude was, you two, Trump and Netanyahu, decided all of this. What are we going to sit down for? Now, I still think they should have sat down, but they didn't. So the, one of the big key pieces Netanyahu wants, because, you know, he's been in trouble over there. He's put together a very precarious government, Dave. So his big missing piece is, what about West Bank annexation? We need to decide by July, you know, early July. And he's waiting for a signal just from Trump himself. We've actually been hedging on this a little bit because the rest of the world basically is saying, they're not saying you don't annex at some point in time, but they're saying, hey, this has to be discussed. That's why Europe got into this. Now, Trump could negate all of that just by saying, yeah, I'm going to give you the green light. So I think we have to hang on for July 1st and see what happens.
Yeah. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron wrote Netanyahu on Monday to say that in the spirit of friendship, that is, the letter was written, according to the French president, said that unilateral steps in the West Bank will undermine the stability in the Middle East. And I think that is one, you know, one sort of concern that some of the Europeans especially are throwing into this, to say that, you know, if we're actually going to get to a lasting peace in the Middle East, you have to bring the Palestinians along. You know, if it does end up with some additional lands being annexed by Israel, maybe that's the result of a peace negotiation. Right. But it seems like are we putting the cart before the horse, I guess.
That's what's happening. And if you do support Israel, it by saying, wait a minute, let's save this for the peace talks, that's a strategy move. It doesn't mean you're anti-Israel. I mean, there are Israelis that don't support this approach, obviously, in their own Knesset, which is their form of Congress.
Yep.
So, yes, it is the cart before the horse. I'm going to be very curious to see how, you know, Trump walks through this, whether he does it or he doesn't do it or half does it. So we're going to have to stay tuned and see what happens.
Meanwhile, we have continuing unrest, really, in Minneapolis and a few other places over the death of George Floyd this week. He was the man who, unarmed African-American man, in confrontation with police in Minneapolis, ended up getting his neck kneeled on and dying as a result by a police officer. And, of course, this, I mean, talk about reminiscent of the Eric Garner case in New York. Both men, as they headed to death, said, "I can't breathe." I mean, I just thought that was, wow, yikes. When will this end?
I mean, we had a case in Congress when I was there, and now this involved a Caucasian, you know, not an African American, but mm-hmm. basically, kind of the same thing happened. He was acting different, acting strange. They placed their bodies on top of him. He had actually a sugar type of problem, and it set him into motion where he died. And so, you know, it was excessive force. Now, on this one, it's coming into the race issue, too, and questions about how, you know, African-Americans are treated. I mean, obviously, what the police did was so excessive, and there's a grand jury, and there's a system, and we'll, you know, see what that system does. I mean, it was terrible. But on the other hand, I would hope there'd be some restraint, and I think that's what some of the leaders are saying, some restraint, because you don't want to have fires burning things down and, you know, other people harassed. So hopefully that part of this will not continue on where you have, you know, basically riots that turn violent.
Yeah, that is obviously always a top concern once one of these incidents happen. I remember, you know, the famous, and I mean, this was maybe the first one of the video recording age or whatever, but the Rodney King case way back in, mm-hmm. I think it was 1991, mm-hmm. in which that was caught on videotape and became, you know, a national media story, largely because it was recorded, and
right.
this is a what do you think of this phenomenon, Bob? Where I mean, I have to say I'm pretty sure that in fact, if you look at news reporting from and investigative series, I remember the Boston Globe did some excellent work along these lines back in the 70s about police brutality and so on, where you really had to work, you know, reporters really had to scrap and work to try to collect evidence of bad behavior by police officers with suspects and so on. But, you know, my sense of this thing is it's been going on for a long, long time, and that The only difference now is that with the advent of video technology now, and now, of course, cell phones, mobile phones with cameras, everybody's a videographer.
Well, it's true. I mean, I had an incident out of nowhere where an officer was becoming violent with me, verbally violent, for frankly no reason, because I was trying to follow where the cones would go to so my car would stop before the light, and it terrified me. And I had actually downloaded, after that incident, downloaded a feature on my phone where you push a button and it instantly transmits whatever's going on with you out to Los Angeles, and then you can say later on, I need you to keep that or not. I mean, I wasn't obviously beaten or killed or anything, but it alarmed me. I mean, it literally, yeah. Dave, was out of nowhere, and it was verbal, but it was threatening and aggressive. So, you know, I thought to myself, you know, maybe you need cell phones. Obviously, you know, cell phones and body cams are something that they're a way of our life.
Yeah, and certainly they are a way to hold some people accountable. Who, sure. It may have been more difficult and less frequent that people were held accountable,
right.
in past decades. And I don't know. I guess my question then, really more as a matter of media studies, is this an improvement? Is this going to be a step toward progress, since there is frankly the opportunity to use video to hold people accountable?
Yeah, I think it is an improvement in the sense that it's an improvement in the sense that, you know, people are able to definitely, you know, record things, definitely, as long as the entire video is seen. Sometimes the media will only clip parts, or people for Facebook will only clip parts, but I think if you see all of it, it puts it in the context and gives us a greater picture of, you know, of accuracy of what's really going on.
Yeah, and obviously there's a maybe all these amateur videographers out there need a media ethics class on some of that stuff, because it shouldn't all be about just proving a point. It should be about an accurate reflection of what actually happened. But sometimes it kind of ends up in both places at the same time. So it's a strange world out there. Of course, now we have the just another example of videography. That case in New York where the woman was calling the police because the guy wanted to put her dog on a leash.
Right.
I mean, that I thought that, and now there's a whole lot of commentary about that and so on, but I think the other shoe that needs to drop here, isn't it, that people need to say, well, what about this? Why does she have all that fear that she displayed, and is there a way to maybe our schools need to step up or something and educate people about the fact that you don't have to have all of this fear just because someone's a different color than you are or looks different from the way you look, and et cetera.
Yeah, and I think it runs both directions, you know, too. The same type of thing can happen from black to white. It can happen from white to black. It happens, you know. And I think probably we kind of fear honest discussions on these issues that are out there. And people like to talk about racial segregation in prison. But honestly, in prison, there's more frank discussions of race with each other than there is on the outside world.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's happening whether some people want it to or not. I mean, by it, I mean just you know, race relations of people working with with people of different backgrounds. It's a happening thing out there. Not only you mentioned prisons, but you know, obviously sports teams is another venue. All sorts of workplaces, you know, and in the arts and so on. And I guess people need to be working on getting past their own their own prejudices in whatever direction. So, hey, Bob Ney, it's great talking with you. Really appreciate you joining me for a slightly longer segment than usual today, and we will let's get together again next week.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Hey, we are coming into a bottom of the hour break. We're going to go to some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors in just a few seconds. I wanted to mention that in the last half hour of the program this morning, we're going to be have a visit with Colin Mine of VTDigger.org. He hasn't been on the show in the last couple of months because he's the news editor at VT Digger, and he's been a very busy guy lately directing their COVID-19 coverage. I think Colin and I are going to be discussing some interesting news just out of Governor Phil Scott, who's made it official he is running for re-election. We'll talk a little bit about that after the break. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and my next guest is a familiar voice on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. He's been a frequent guest on the program over the couple of years I've been doing it here, and but not so much in the last couple of months. He also has been an occasional host, as taking the pinch hitting for me when I'm away. And Colin Mine is an editor at vtdigger.org. He's been real busy lately with the COVID-19 coverage there, and so has been a little bit less available to us, but we are really glad to have you back this morning, Colin. Thanks for joining me.
Certainly one of the lesser consequences, the lesser traumas of this virus has been me not being on the show so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Well, it's been a trauma for me, so I don't know, but that's all right. I shouldn't talk about my own traumas. That's terrible. Anyway, let's see here. The big news, I guess, this morning, just appearing on VT Digger a little bit earlier today, is that it's official. I think we all expected it and maybe even knew it. But yes, indeed, Governor Phil Scott is going to be seeking a third 2-year term as the chief executive of the state of Vermont. So talk to us a little bit about that, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, pretty expected here. It would have been pretty tough on the Republican Party, I think, if in the state, given the situation, if Phil Scott had announced anything different than what he did announce, which is that he's running for a third term. I thought what was most interesting about his announcement is that he said he's not going to do any campaigning or any fundraising until he's not going to have a campaign staff even until the state of emergency is finished, which certainly, could exist in some way or another through the November election. So you could basically see the incumbent governor, heading into both the primary and the general election, exhausting zero resources in campaigning. He noted in his statement that, it's strange for someone in his position who spent 2 decades in politics, but he said that his least favorite part of public service is the politics. So, I think the indication there is that, we've heard many times before that doing things like, calling donors and, is really not something that Phil Scott enjoys, not something that he's done a whole lot of, even in his last campaign. But there's going to be none of it for the foreseeable future here. And you have to think that given the way that Vermont has, weathered the coronavirus, at least so far, that no amount of campaigning can create as much goodwill for the governor as, preventing deaths and illness and that sort of thing. So I think that he is incredibly well positioned to win a third term, probably doesn't have to do a lot of campaigning, and somewhat surprising that he won't. But we've got the governor's race shaped out here. He's got one primary opponent, John Klar, who calls himself an ag Republican, is really focused on sort of economic conservatism as well as trying to revive the real workforce. He's sort of a newcomer to statewide politics and isn't expected to give Governor Scott much of a challenge in the primary. And then there's quite a competitive race over on the Democratic side between the Lieutenant Governor, David Zuckerman, former Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, and another newcomer named Patrick Winburn, who's a personal injury attorney from Bennington. And that will be a three-way race there on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I'm just sort of wondering, I do think that Governor Scott has some huge built-in advantages here. I remember, back in 2011 when Tropical Storm Irene hit, and Governor Peter Shumlin was given high marks for the way he handled the state's response to that disaster. And a lot of folks thought that really helped with his reelection prospects. I think that kind of phenomenon, it's a worse disaster this time in many ways. And just certainly in terms of the longer term impact on the state's economy and budget and so on, and in terms of just the overall sort of disruption of normal life, and I'd say that the state's response has been even more thorough and wide ranging, really, in terms of all the agencies and folks brought to bear on this, If there's a bump, this sort of a disaster bump, we'll call it, just as a little shorthand or whatever, it's got to be a bigger one for Phil Scott, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, totally. I think that, you see these sort of leadership bumps during crises generally, whether federal or state. Certainly, those bumps vary depending on how successful the leader is. Even Donald Trump hasn't really seen, has actually seen increased support among some folks for his response to the coronavirus, by virtue of people wanting to sort of trust their leaders during times of crises and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think that Governor Scott was in a really strong position. It was being listed by some of the governor's race as sort of, reliably red or, I think right now it's sort of safely red in terms of whether it's going to go to the Republican or not. You'd have to think that what was already a very strong position for the governor has only gotten stronger here in the past few months, and that, for folks like David Zuckerman, who's leaving his position as lieutenant governor to try to take on Phil Scott, that the chances that he ends up in that office in a few months are pretty low.
Do you think Zuckerman regrets his decision? I mean, he made it before this pandemic broke, and it was going to be an uphill climb to begin with. It seems like a steeper hill now.
Yeah, I really don't know. I'm sure that, in some way he's not thrilled by the situation, but the fact that it also, that we're in, that Phil Scott is in this position largely because Vermont has really succeeded in preventing the spread of the virus is obviously good news for anyone who cares about the state. So, if the choice is between saving lives and Governor Scott being reelected, I would imagine that most of his opponents would prefer to save lives. That being said, certainly we plan to talk to the Lieutenant Governor about the current situation soon. And, as we sort of gear up for the primaries here, we'll have profiles and all that sort of thing of the candidates that answer all the questions folks might want to know.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see whether, my first thought is to call up the governor's office or his campaign and say, I'd like to bring candidates for office onto my radio show here at WDEV, and actually have done a little bit of that in the last couple of weeks, and I'm eager for the governor to take a turn, and love to have him on and just talk about where he sees his overall career as governor right now, and basically get him to talk up why he should be reelected and so on. And is he, and V.T. Digger is going to want to sit down with him and say, pretty much have a similar exchange and sure, do it up in printed form and maybe also in your podcast and I just wonder whether his statement that I'm not going to do any campaigning and not going to raise any money, is that going to extend to these media interviews that would normally be happening this time of year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. Maybe as the general election approaches, we'll see a bit more of, you know, availability in terms of Phil Scott, the candidate. You know, it's interesting, the press conferences that he's been giving three times a week, you know, have really stayed fairly focused on the coronavirus and, you know, the million different ways that it has impacted society and the orders that the governor has made and continues to sort of change. And, you know, when we've raised questions like, are you going to run again, which is a question that, you know, everyone had for weeks leading up to this, you know, we were told, well, that's not really on topic here, and maybe this isn't the right venue for that question. Unfortunately, there's not really any other venue to ask the governor these types of questions, apart from what you pointed out, which is sort of, you know, making individual requests for interviews and that kind of thing. So, you know, as much as Phil Scott might not like politics, he is indeed a politician, and in fact, the most important politician in the state. So yep. I think that there is, you know, a duty for his campaign to the extent, even though he says he doesn't have any staff, you know, someone's got to send out the emails and make sure the paperwork's filed and that kind of thing. So you would hope, for the sake of transparency and democracy, that his office doesn't completely pretend like he's not a politician because he's dealing with a very, very, very important response to the coronavirus here.
Yeah. Hey, let's shift focus. And speaking of, I mean, response to the coronavirus, maybe a little more broadly or more technically or more public health oriented here. And that is an interesting headline in VT Digger that Vermont is hitting about 1,000 tests a day. And you know, that's more daily tests than we've had cases, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a lot more. There have been a couple of sort of important milestones that Vermont has hit 1,000 tests a day, which they say is necessary in order to sort of start reopening the economy and to really have a gauge of whether the virus is spreading again and to identify any potential spreading before it turns into an outbreak, certainly before, you know, it gets to a shared living facility, a nursing home, anything like that. And, yeah, I mean, very few cases. It's now been 10 days since the death in Vermont, which is quite impressive considering what you're seeing happening in some of the states around the region. The governor has also talked about, you know, starting to look at things regionally rather than in Vermont because Vermont's numbers are so promising that there's sort of a danger in complacency if you don't also look across the border and realize that those states are still really struggling to suppress the virus. And then another sort of interesting milestone was there was zero hospitalizations reported yesterday morning. Apparently one patient was going to be placed on that list sort of momentarily when we spoke to the administration, or rather when the administration spoke to reporters yesterday afternoon. But still, just really promising figures here in Vermont, even as things open up. You know, we've looked at, as the governor sort of opened things up step by step or with each turn of the spigot, as he describes it, you know, sort of reopening, attempting to reopen childcare and restaurants and limited reopening and manufacturing and construction and all this kind of stuff. And that you see people moving around a bit more, but we're not seeing the data even 2 or 3 weeks after these moves have been made, really changing any of the disease data in terms of cases or deaths, which, you know, is great. Obviously, the health commissioner, Mark Levine, has warned, you know, we can't be complacent. That, you know, it doesn't take much for, you know, spreading to occur again, especially when people start to gather in big groups. So, you know, sort of taking all this with a grain of salt, but realizing that the numbers in Vermont are just looking really fantastic right now in terms of its ability to take additional steps to reopen, which the governor has been doing on a weekly basis, if not more often than that.
Yeah, it's fascinating and also somewhat scary because if you look at even New Hampshire, you know, which we're often sort of regarded as twin states up here or whatever, but and Massachusetts and New York, of course, New York's mainly in the metropolitan area, but all the states surrounding us have just hugely higher numbers of both coronavirus cases and coronavirus deaths. And you know, you look at Massachusetts, and it doesn't really seem to be abating down there to any big extent. Maybe a little bit, and I mean, it almost seems that it's inevitable that it will return here in some fashion. What are you hearing about that concern?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of autumn rebound, I think, is something that a lot of people are really mindful of and something that the administration says that it's planning for. And, you know, that's the idea that coronaviruses tend to sort of subside a bit in warmer weather. And, you know, there's not a lot of fantastic research, obviously, because this novel coronavirus hasn't really existed before. But I think there's some expectation that it may sort of subside a bit in the warmer months. But then sort of tracking previous pandemics, pandemic viruses elsewhere in time and in the world, that it may rebound when the weather gets colder again. So sort of making sure that, you know, we are prepared both as a state and as a country for that potential. You know, there's these like surge facilities that went up at the beginning of the spread in mid-March at UVM and in Rutland as well. And, you know, these cost quite a bit of money and were sort of, you know, if the health system became overwhelmed, would be sort of spillover for emergency treatment. It turns out they weren't really needed, but they are sort of keeping them at the ready. I think they're packing them up, but they'll be prepared to stand them up quickly if that's necessary. And then, you know, there's really contact tracing where you identify positive cases early on and then identify any contacts that might have had and have those people stay in isolation. You know, I think that's really the cornerstone of the administration's strategy to deal with any sort of spike that may occur in later months, is to identify that far earlier on and prevent the sort of, you know, failure to intervene that happened in March that led to outbreaks in nursing homes that still account for almost half of the deaths in Vermont 2 months later.
Yeah, that that is clearly an issue there. I wonder also, though, I mean, we have our hospitality industry historically and our restaurant industry both have relied on business from places like Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut and places with much higher incidence of coronavirus. I had Tracy Dolan on, the deputy health commissioner, earlier in the show today, and you know, she was really very insistent that we have to remain as vigilant as ever, and that folks need to keep that mindset going that we all had probably back in March and April about just how scary this is and how likely it is to suddenly bloom if we don't keep paying attention. But you know, meanwhile, the normal human tendency, I think, is to get a little complacent. A lot of these places where people typically congregate in the summer in Vermont, beaches and parks and lodging facilities and so on, are really chomping at the bits to get back to normal life. How do we sort of, and actually we had a call from Jackie Folsom, who said she'd spent the weekend down at Lake Bomazene in Rutland County, and was telling us that there were a whole bunch of people there from out of state who had come in, a lot of folks from just nearby in New York State, and you know, it's very near the state line. The folks from Pennsylvania and Connecticut, I think she said, who were kind of coming and going and acting like there was no problem with this coronavirus thing at all. And it was kind of an eye opener, it sounded like, for her. And so what do you think, Colin? Is Vermont going to continue to somehow strike a balance here? Are we going to be able to open up that lodging and restaurant sector enough to actually keep them viable, or where are we heading here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the concern shared by your listeners is certainly something that we hear from readers all the time, which is, you know, wondering, we're doing so well here. Numbers are looking good. You know, the idea that if we can somehow keep people from neighboring states away, that will sort of keep Vermont safe. And I think what you've been hearing from the administration, and Phil Scott in particular, is that, you know, we're not going to start sort of flagging all out-of-staters as being people who need to get out of the state. You know, that there are rules in place. They need to quarantine for 14 days when they enter the state, if indeed they plan on staying. But that, you know, beyond that, I think it's pretty clear that the Scott administration is not interested in sort of, you know, sending police out to monitor people coming from out of state and that kind of thing. Certainly as hotels and other sort of Airbnb types of things are allowed to basically start rolling again at the middle of this month, you know, you'd think that would encourage more people coming in from out of state. And it's unclear that there will be any sort of enforcement mechanisms either on the businesses or on the state to make sure that people are quarantining for that recommended 2 weeks. Yes, I mean, you know, certainly good reason for concern from people. And I think that a lot of people are sort of not satisfied with the lack of action, I guess, that the administration is taking to sort of address the issue of people coming in from out of state. It's not entirely clear that, you know, there's the anecdotes, but whether or not, you know, traditionally, obviously, tourism in the summer and winter in Vermont goes gangbusters, and there's not a tremendous amount of data at this point to show whether or not that's going to happen. I mean, you know, sort of reopening is one thing, and then whether or not there's actually a demand for these hotels and restaurants is another question. I guess Memorial Day weekend was something of a limit test for that, and it sounds like there was not a significant increase in traffic. I think the governor said that there was a mid-50,000 people coming into the state in previous weekends, and Memorial Day weekend was something closer to 60,000. So not a tremendous jump on that front, but certainly you think that as, you know, hotels are able to take reservations again, as the weather gets better, that this is going to become more and more of an issue, and probably more and more of a sort of point of tension between, you know, the administration, other policymakers, and folks on the ground who are seeing out-of-state cars and wondering whether or not that poses a health risk to them.
Yeah, it is going to be an ongoing struggle, I think, for months to come. Let's shift gears a little bit here, and I mean, another sector of the Vermont economy hugely affected by this coronavirus pandemic, of course, has been our healthcare system, and the finances of our hospitals are in pretty rough shape. I read in vtdigger.org, so tell us about that, Colin Mine.
Yeah, I mean, predictably, we shut down for regular business and prepare themselves to be, you know, for whatever COVID response might be necessary. And in doing so, essentially, you know, shut down their entire cash flow, which is largely based around elective surgeries. And elective surgeries tend to, you know, sort of offset the other costs. The revenue from elective surgeries offsets the other costs of running a hospital. So without that, they're, you know, in very dire financial straits. Something that they make clear to the administration. Agency of Human Services Secretary Mike Smith yesterday, both in a press conference with reporters and then speaking to the Green Mountain Care Board, which regulates hospitals, and then speaking to legislators, talked about his plans to have a $300 million hospital relief package available to hospitals starting in mid-June that would help them sort of maintain financial solvency in the months ahead. Our healthcare reporter, Katie Dickling, talked to representatives of the industry, both sort of long-term care folks and hospitals. And they say, you know, obviously they support any sort of help they can get, but the $300 million alone isn't going to sort of be enough to get them on sound financial footing. They've also been applying for grants and received quite a lot of federal money already to sort of help them see their way through the past couple months. So as with basically everything in terms of financial problems here, it's really going to depend on the federal government to decide how much to help. And, you know, the state has some ability to direct the $1.25 billion that's already been provided in the CARES Act money. But, you know, that's going quickly. It sounds like there might be $300 million of that that's earmarked for hospitals, but hospitals say they need more than that. And, you know, again, this has sort of compounded an issue that really was, you know, very serious and on everyone's radar anyway, which is that small hospitals in Vermont are having a really tough time. You know, Springfield Hospital has sort of been a canary in the coal mine, as it were, in terms of basically, you know, having to file for bankruptcy and getting emergency bailouts from the state. And that was even before the coronavirus. So, you know, now to have months and months of basically zero cash flow is only compounding that problem. And another thing that's certainly going to be discussed and a priority here in the months ahead.
Yeah, this is a really common theme with this coronavirus pandemic, which is that many of the social problems, everything from the financial weakness of some of our hospitals to you know, income inequality and maybe inadequate healthcare access to healthcare for a lot of folks, All of these problems that had been longstanding before the coronavirus showed up seem to have been laid even more bare by this pandemic. And it's a common theme that keeps coming up here on the Dave Graham Show, WDEV, FM, and AM. So go ahead.
Sorry, just quickly. I do think that one area that has really was on everyone's radar anyway, particularly Representative Peter Welch talks about it often, including on your show, but the sort of broadband gap. I think that that's something that has really emerged as being something that can't wait to sort of address, you know, that you just can't live the same life as other people who have fast broadband in terms of teleworking and telehealth and school and everything without some equality in terms of online access. And, you know, obviously some people in Vermont don't need it and don't want it. But for those who do live in rural areas, I think that there's a recognition right now that this is really an emergency issue. And I'd be surprised if a significant amount of the federal money didn't eventually go towards really trying to connect more people to high-speed internet in Vermont.
Well, we'll have to ask Congressman Welch about that Monday morning when he's my guest on the Dave Graham Show. Colin, thanks for mentioning him and reminding me for that programming note. That's great. We are just about down to the last minute here or so, and I just want to commend people to vtdigger.org and its excellent ongoing coverage of the COVID-19 crisis in Vermont and all the different ways the state and our economy are responding. It's a ton of information, and as I mentioned at the top, Colin has not been hearing often enough for my taste lately because he's been busy shepherding a lot of that as a top editor at VT Digger. But we got him today, so Colin Mine, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, it was great to talk again, Dave.
All right, let's do it again soon. As soon as you can, that is. Hey, that's about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show on this Thursday, May the 28th. And thank you very much, listeners, for checking in with us. Please do so again tomorrow morning. And keep washing your hands, stay healthy, keep vigilant, as Tracy Dolan recommends. Talk to you soon.